The following program is a presentation of the FlyPod New Media Network. www.theflypod.com.
FlyPod.com. I'm Mark DeWitt. Welcome to Cover to Cover. Today it's the number one New York Times best-selling author Greg Iles. He has a brand new book, Matches Burning. Greg, welcome.
Glad to be here, Mark.
This book is huge, Greg. It's like, what, 800-900 pages?
It's 800 pages, right at that. Yeah, it's a doorstop.
It is. Now, tell me a little bit about Natchez Burning, because this book has a lot of stories, and they're all intertwined in this book.
Well, and the unbelievable thing is that it's only a third of the whole story. 3 years ago, I was about a week from finishing the one-volume conception of this story. I was unhappy with it, though, because it deals with my family, race, the South, and I pulled on the Highway 61, and a truck hit my driver's door going 70 miles an hour, tore my aorta, took my leg off at the knee, broke 20-something bones, and I woke up out of a coma 8 days later. When that happened, I just took a whole new look at the book. I said, you know, I'm mortal. I don't have an infinite number of books. I'm going to say what I need to say. I'm not going to worry about sales. I'm not going to worry about my publisher. And I wound up with a new publisher, new agent, and the book grew from 1 to 3. So it's truly an epic novel about the South.
And Natchez Burning, book number one in the series?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, number one.
All right. Now, are the other volumes going to be as massive?
Not quite as big. The second one was, and I'm trimming it down. Really, nobody even suggested it, but I just wanted to make it a little leaner. The third book is more a courtroom novel, but it's pretty big. I mean, when you deal with themes, you know, ironically, this book, 800 pages, takes place in 1 week, but it spans 40 years when you include the flashbacks. So when you start trying to take on subjects like race and civil rights in the South, that's a thick tapestry, and it takes some space.
Of course, you being from the South, is that still the case?
Well, that's a big question. You know, that's one of the themes I deal with in the novel. I mean, let me say I'm about as Southern as you come. You know, my ancestors fought for the South in the Civil War. My mother was raised on a cotton farm, picked cotton until she graduated college. I grew up in Natchez, but I worked in summers with African-American guys digging ditches, loading trucks. And most importantly, my dad was a doctor who treated about 60% of his practice was African-American. And then I went to Ole Miss, lived in a house Faulkner hung out in as a kid a lot. I studied under Willie Morris, and he brought writers like William Steyer and James Dickey. You know, I'm about as Southern as you can get. And you know, people ask, what kind of research did you do for this? I didn't have to do any research. You know, I live this. And when you're in the South, storytelling is sort of second nature. And when you say, is it still the case? You know, race is probably the most complex issue in the United States, I would say. It's still with us. Look at the Donald Sterling case. You know, when President Obama was elected, people start talking about a post-racial society. Nothing could be funnier or further from the truth. And so racism is still with us, and it's not limited to the South. I mean, we could go into it more if you like, but that's what I'd say.
Well, how about the North and the South? I was listening to Garrison Keillor the other day, and he was interviewing somebody, and he wanted to know what the difference was between a Yankee and a damn Yankee.
Now, I don't know the difference between that, but I'll tell you a little bit about the North and the South, and that is people frequently ask me why so many great authors have been from Mississippi. You can go all the way back to Faulkner and Tennessee Williams, and you can cross over into music with the blues and Elvis, and on to now, Donna Tartt just won the Pulitzer, you know, Richard Wright, you know, black author. I mean, it's just an endless list, really. People say, is it something in the water? I'll tell you what it is. It's while the rest of the country, with economic prosperity in the 20th century, grew more and more homogenous. I pull off the interstate, everywhere looks the same. It doesn't matter what state I'm in. But when you're in Mississippi, you know where you are. Okay. It doesn't all look the same. People there in those towns, you're living with people who have 3, 4, 5, 6 generations have lived right there within 10 miles. And here's another thing people don't expect. You know, ask Morgan Freeman why he comes back to Mississippi in his spare time. You know, he said, I think his age he picked until he was like 55, he didn't understand why his parents even wanted to go back to Mississippi. And yet now he himself does. There's something about the South and a connection to the land and community that is unique. It's not completely unique in the country, but I think there are only pockets of America that still retain that individuality. And that's what art is about. It's about having a voice. And to get an individual voice, you need to grow up in an individual place, I think.
And I would guess that maybe the South, like, oh, I'm thinking of Wyoming and some of the West out there, a little bit slower, too. So you have a different look at life.
Oh, yeah. It's certainly, you know, you're talking about a place that's still pretty rural. We're always, I would say we were always 15 years behind the rest of the country as far as the development of pop culture. And you're talking about a place where there wasn't much to do but think or play the guitar or whatever it was. And storytelling, that oral tradition. You know, I did a thing the other day. I won't name names. It was some pretty famous authors, and we were all in front of about 1,000 people at lunch. And, you know, I had people laughing and rolling in the floor. And one of the guys came up to me after, and he said, man, you Southern guys like Rick Bragg, and, you know, you just got this storytelling thing, and it's hard to compete with that. But that's, you know, hey, there's some not so good things about being from the South, but that's one of the good things.
Well, Natchez Burning opens up with a great hook. I mean, here we are in the South. There's some loving between the whites and the blacks going on, I think, and the Ku Klux Klan and the law, which you say is one and the same, just not happy about this. And they're looking to hang somebody, huh?
Well, you covered a lot of ground right there. I'll say a couple things about that. One, as far as interracial relationships in the South, all you have to do is drive through and look at the color of the people to see nobody's really, really black. You know, there's been a lot of intermixing. It's not talked about, but that's the way it is. All right. In terms of the Ku Klux Klan, I'd like to say this. You know, I've written several what they'd call Southern Gothic novels, and I never used the Klan as antagonists, and I'll tell you why. The Klan was pretty much completely infiltrated by the FBI by the mid to late 60s, and they ceased to be a real large-scale threat. They still hurt some people, etc., but many of the top Klan officers were informants for the FBI, taking a weekly check. Now, a few years ago, I got to know a guy who's now a friend, a small reporter. He's a basis for the character Henry Sexton in the book. Across the river from Natchez, he started investigating the murders of some just regular African-American folks that had been unsolved for 40 years, not civil rights leaders, and they were murdered by a group called the Silver Dollar Group. Klan offshoot. They never had meetings. They didn't wear robes. Each man carried a silver dollar minted in the year of his birth, and all they did was kill people. And not one went to jail for at least 40 years. And to this day, only one has done so. When I found that, I knew I had the large scale background I wanted to use to put my foreground story against.
When you're doing this, when you're writing a book like this, how do you keep everything straight with what you're doing? I mean, that's a lot of going back and forth, I guess.
That's one of the, in all honesty, when people ask about writing, that's one of the, I think, gifts that you have to have. People don't realize this, but it's probably the reason I had my accident that I told you about. That was a week before the end. You have to reach a state where the entire universe of the novel that you've created, if you think of it as sort of a grand perpetual motion machine sort of whirling in your head with everything from who your fourth grade teacher was in the villain's life to the tiniest detail of cotton growing or some crime and some, it's unbelievable. You've got to know about history, philosophy, psychology, and you got to hold it all in your head. When you reach that point, you don't know what day it is, what year it is, what time it is. That was the state I was in when I pulled out on that road. And so, you know, it's a valid question. I know some authors who have note cards all over the wall and push pens. I don't do it that way. For me, it's an organic living thing. And that's how you bring a story alive.
So with your accident, how has that changed your idea for writing?
Well,
I mean, I think you touched on it a little.
I did, but I can tell you a little more about that. You know, we were talking before the interview, and I told you I play in a band with Stephen King and Scott Turow and some other writers. You know, in 1999, Steve was hit by a van, run over, almost killed. And so I had seen him go through that experience, and I've talked to him, and it's a transformative thing. Because as I said, we go through life denying death and denying how fragile life is because it scares you to death to think about it. But when something like this happens, you're forced to confront that you've got a limited amount of time. And you realize if you have something to say, why are you waiting to say it? And everything in the publishing business, the commercial business, the bestseller business, I would say, and my novel prior to this one 5 years ago was number one. So I was where people are trying to get when they want to become a successful writer. The problem is you wind up on this sort of hamster wheel where all the economic pressure is to write a book just like your last one. That's what you see a lot of writers do in that. And I'm not blaming them or saying anything negative about it, but that's not the way to get the best books necessarily. And so that's a long way to say when you confront mortality the way that accident forced me to do, and when you're writing about serious issues, it makes you say, I'm not pulling a single punch, okay? If I have to use the N-word, I'll use it. If I have to upset somebody, I'm going to upset them. I'm writing now about the world the way it is, not the way it ought to be. So if somebody wants something sugar-coated, they should buy somebody else's book.
So how about the books before the accident? What were those sugar-coated? Were those the way that you were?
I'll say this. When I went to Ole Miss, I was in a writing class under the writer Willie Morris, and I'll tell you two other authors who were in there, John Grisham and Donna Tartt. Different years for me, but right in there, the same experience. And John wrote A Time to Kill, you know, wonderful book, and nobody wanted to buy it. And he said, well, you know, if they don't want this, and he wrote The Firm, and, you know, the rest is history. Sold more books than anybody on the planet. The other extreme would be Donna, who wrote The Secret History, made a good deal of money, took 10 years to write her second, 10 or 12 to write the third, and now won the Pulitzer Prize. So those are sort of two ends of how you approach it. I'm in the middle. I've written some very commercial novels, and I've written some very deep, heavy novels. You know, I've written about the Holocaust. I've written about repressed memory of child abuse, but they were always thrillers. So that's a hard thing to do, is keep people turning pages and yet deal with real issues. So I've sort of meandered through. At times I've been serious, at times more exciting. But with the accident, I thought, and with my dad dying just prior to it, I said, you know what? I'm going to write a book he would be proud of. And it just changed me, you know?
What would you say, Natchez Burning, historical fiction?
You know, I guess I would say that. That's the closest thing to it, even though it's set in the present. It has the historical fiction feel, a journalistic feel. But the most shocking thing, I think, is the reality of it. I particularly have a lot of African-American people come up to me and say, at signings, and say, you know, I have to put this book down for a few hours. I love reading it. I think it's important. But boy, it's so real, it's hard for me to read. So, you know, I think that's a good thing, but people need to come to it with their eyes open.
You know, just not an author. I know you touched on this a little bit ago, too, but a bandmate of several authors.
Yeah, I'm almost embarrassed to name them. There's so many luminaries, but Stephen King, Amy Tan, Scott Turow, Dave Barry, I should say him twice, Ridley Pearson, Mitch Albom, Matt Groening, who invented The Simpsons. I mean, Roger McGuinn from The Birds plays almost every show with us. So you can imagine how much fun that is. And I've been quoting Amy Tan on this book tour a lot, which we play usually for children's literacy. But as Amy has said, we have so much fun doing this, we would kill baby whales to get to have this much fun. You know, I've had some of my best times. You know, I'd like to tell the listeners really that writing, as opposed to music, you know, I was a musician before I was a writer for 8 years. Being a musician is so much fun, and it's so interactive, and you get immediate emotional return. Writing books, you just sit in a room by yourself 1, 2, 3 years. So for us writers to get to go back and be on stage and have fun, and it's just, that's a great side of it. And then to get to be with other writers who, there are only a few writers in each state, I think, who are best-selling authors or just successful authors. And so to get to spend a week on the road in a bus, I mean, I've gotten to sit in the back of the bus and talk to Scott Turow about how he wrote Presumed Innocent, or I've had Stephen King tell me the story of novels that now exist before they were written. I mean, it's just a privilege, you know?
And Stephen King doesn't do really any interviews anymore. I'm sure he did at one point.
You know, I don't know about that. I'll tell you, having been on the road with them, they're different levels of stardom. And I've seen, I think, all of them now. I've been around actors. I've been around different levels of writers. But Stephen King generates a kind of hysteria that it's hard to describe. I've been in situations that seem almost scary. They get so out of control because he has true cult fans. I think Steve surpasses being a best-selling author. He's sort of a cultural icon like the Beatles were. And when you see that, it makes you think, you know, I'm not sure how famous I really want to get, you know?
So in the band, who's the biggest diva?
I plead the Fifth Amendment on that. We really don't have divas in that band. It's sort of like when they did We Are the World, you know, leave your ego at the door. I'll tell you, the hardest thing is to book the band, because when you have that many people who are that famous, their schedules are booked out 2 years at a time. And so to find dates where we can all get together and play is hard. And they've turned down some pretty remarkable gigs. I don't want to say too much, but the White House on one occasion and other things. We once had to not play for, we were going to get to warm up Nora Jones and Bob Dylan, and we had to miss that because of previous commitments. That almost killed me, you know, but that's the way it is. And hey, those are good problems to have. Okay. I'm not complaining.
So who's your favorite group or singer?
Oh man, that's like saying, well, who's your favorite novelist or what's your favorite book? You know, I'm old now. You know, if I go back to my prime, I'm a fan of Crosby, Stills, Nash and Young. If now I'm a Sting fan, you know, I've got a younger fiance, as you can see. She introduces me to newer bands that I would never have known about otherwise. As far as I'm concerned, it's like after about 1985, music kind of stopped there.
Greg, you know, I've talked to some authors that they have to have music playing. Maybe they have that songbook of their book or something that they're using as they write. Do you do that yourself?
Absolutely. I do more than that. And I write in a very, very weird way. I go a lot of the year without writing anything, and the story's just working in my subconscious. Then when it comes time, I say it's like a pregnant woman when your water breaks. It's like, bang, the whole story's there. I sit down in a lazy boy. I have a hospital table that rolls over me with two monitors and a TV screen, stereo. I not only play music while I'm writing, sometimes I run movies in the background that aren't too annoying, like Pride and Prejudice or something like that, or I'll get hooked on a movie. I'll keep the sound low. And when I'm in that zone, I drink Tab, the soft drink, while I'm doing it nonstop and eat. I never get out of the chair for 20, 30 hours. I've even gone 40 hours. And, I will write about 30 pages a day at that rate, and I'll rarely go back to change. It's sort of like you've got to get in this mental zone, and out it comes, and you never look back.
What's your favorite snack to eat when you're writing?
Well, in the old days, it would have been something totally deleterious, like Twinkies or something. But now it tends to be more granola bars or something like that, you know?
Well, Natchez Burning, of course, the first book in the series. Give me a little bit more flavor of this book. Take me in a little bit without giving anything away, really. And that's a tough part, I think.
In terms of across the trilogy, I can say this. The first book really was to bring people into this world of the true Deep South, which is hard to do for people who've never been there. There's so many misconceptions about the South. The second book is more a pure thriller, with the antagonist and protagonist against each other. And then the third book is probably the best book I've ever written. It's a courtroom novel. You know, one reviewer called this William Faulkner for the Breaking Bad generation. I would say the third book is sort of a To Kill a Mockingbird for the Breaking Bad generation. As far as the tone of the book, how do you tell people, you know, what the real South is like? You know, we're talking about a place where black and white have lived together, truly together, for hundreds of years. You know, there were times not so long ago where a single county in Mississippi had more African American people in it than seven or eight northern states put together. Okay. One of the things I draw in this book, I think people should be aware of, is how universal prejudice and racism is. I'll give you a quick example. in 1964, when the three civil rights workers went missing, one of the biggest manhunts in history began. It involved the National Guard, the Armed Services, the FBI. During that time, nine other bodies were found in Mississippi. Okay? Two of them were two 19-year-old black boys murdered, found in an offshoot of the river. For a few hours, it was hysteria while they believed that the civil rights workers had been found. But as soon as it was determined they were just two black boys from Mississippi, the spotlight went back to Neshoba County, and it was 40 more years before those crimes were solved. Now, the lesson here is that it wasn't simply that in the South people were apathetic and didn't try to solve that with those two boys. Nobody in the North pushed for that either. The FBI put it on the back burner. So the point is that it's easy to look at the Deep South and say, oh, look at those racist rednecks. No, apathy about that problem and prejudice is universal. And many African Americans who fled North over throughout the 20th century found that as soon as they competed for jobs in the North, hey, it wasn't paradise. So it's a complex issue.
That's just burning, bringing this thing to life, bringing it visually to life. How do you do that? Because I thought that was a great art right there.
Thank you. You know, when you're writing about a place you grew up in, it's probably easier. In fact, I think when you're trying to write a novel of this type, you almost have to grow up in the place. You know, you have to write A Lonesome Dove, you have to be in that environment for a long time. You know, and this is similar. You got to know what kudzu feels like and smells like. You got to have been down in a bayou or a lake with alligators and gar. I mean, you can't fake that, okay? You got to have dug ditches with black guys for a couple of years, man. You got to know how they talk. And if you're going to not pull punches, you can't be afraid to say what they say. And I got some redneck friends, and, you know, what they say is in there, too. And all that, you take it, you weave it together, or maybe I'd say it's more like making a gumbo. You put it all in there together. You know, the thing some writers don't understand is this. You know a lot. You may know a lot about a subject. You may research a lot. But you only use a tiny percentage to create that willing suspension of disbelief, you know? You'll know when you read a book from an author who's not as good at that, you can almost feel them making that effort to convince you of something. And I never want it to be that way. What I want is from the first sentence, I want the reader to feel like they may not know where I'm going, but they know I know where I'm going, and they trust me to take them there, you know?
That just burning. How about Hollywood on this? Are they on board?
The reaction to this book in Hollywood has been just crazy. I mean, I've had a film before. I've had options before. But since this book came out, the phone has not stopped ringing. I've literally had major Hollywood actors who want to fly out and meet me on the road and talk about playing this character. Now, why is that? I ask myself, you know, why suddenly? And here's what I think it is. America's changed in the last, I think, since about 2008 in the meltdown. You know, I think the older paradigm, which was more like the firm, young idealistic lawyer over his head, that kind of thing, that's sort of where we were as a culture. And my books were a little too extreme for that. Mine were always more violent, more sexual, etc. But the culture has shifted to about where True Detective with Matthew McConaughey and Woody Harrelson is, where Game of Thrones is. You know, movies are pretty much today made for 14-year-old boys. Adults are watching HBO and Netflix at home, 8, 9, 10 episodes of a series at once with no commercials. And that is where the best actors want to act. And Natchez Burning, I think simply because I've lived long enough and survived long enough, I'm suddenly in the center of the culture instead of being off to the side. So it's a great place to be. It's be careful what you wish for, because you always think, oh yeah, I'd love to have a huge movie or this, but then actors start calling you and you start thinking, okay, wait a minute. Is this exactly what I pictured? You know, it's hard to find.
That is pretty cool, though, right?
It's a good problem to have. Yeah. I'll say that.
Well, if I wanted to find out more about Natchez Burning, your other books, Greg Iles, I'm sure you've got a website.
I mean, just go to gregiles.com. And here's what I'll say about me. The one thing I'd like to say is if you read one book of mine, you may not like it. But don't give up, because so many of my backlist titles are so different. I have books that are essentially World War II thrillers. And I have books that are female protagonist psychological novels. So I really have written all across the landscape. So it's sort of potluck chance there.
What's your favorite genre to write, and what's your favorite to read?
I can't really answer that. Again, it's always narrowing down to one. I'm an options kind of guy. You know, what I want, I say this. I like to read, what I like to read about and what my books are really about is, what is the nature of evil? Why do good people do bad things? Sometimes even in a self-destructive way. Is anyone completely evil, or does everybody have good? Those are the questions I'm trying to answer no matter what I'm watching or reading or writing. And I think that's what interests most people.
All right, so I guess it depends on the day and time on what you like to read and everything.
You got it. That's right.
Some authors don't mind reading something while they're writing. Are you like that?
A lot of writers are gifted mimics, and me being a musician, I think even more so. I have to be careful while I'm writing because let's say I'm reading Robert Ben Warren, All the King's Men, or I'm reading John le Carré, or I happen to like Martin Cruz Smith. If I read 2-3 novels by one of those guys, and I'm a very fast reader, so I might read 2 or 3 novels in 2 or 3 days, I'll find myself unconsciously absorbing their style, and I'll see it come out on the page right in front of me. And it'll take me 2-3 pages to realize it. So I think it's a risk for writers who have that sort of mimic ability. You know, the band wrote a book recently about our experiences, an interactive book called Hard Listening, and they had a contest to see which of us could write the most like Stephen King and fool the reader. So Dave Barry, myself, Ridley Pearson all did it, and this complex computer program analyzed it. But it was an interesting exercise, given your question, you know, when you're trying, how close could you come to somebody else's style, you know? So, yeah, it's funny. Anyway.
Well, you know, I'd like to find out more, especially about the band, how you write the music and everything. I'd love to have you back for another interview. Anyway, you know, Natchez Burning, what I like to do with this book is I like to read it out loud because I know it's a Southern book, and I like to give it that little bit of a Southern lilt when I read. And I have a lot of fun with that as I do other books. Natchez Burning, it's a great book to read and a great book to do that with, and a fantastic story. Greg, thanks a lot.
Thank you, and don't read it aloud on the bus or the subway. That's my advice.
You've been listening to Cover to Cover. I've been your host, Mark DeWitt, along with Greg Iles, author of his brand new book, Natchez Burning. To access this or other audio programming, visit our website, theflypod.com.